So, you were born in the Bronx, but you went out to the Midwest to school, huh?
University of Missouri. A weird accident. Just sort of arrogantly, I thought I could get into any school I wanted to. That only applied to one school, Columbia, for pre-med. Because I think all 35 of my friends were going to be doctors and possibly dentists. So I applied too, you know, having no interest in it. And I didn't get in. So I was left without a school. And some girl at camp, we used to call them girls back then, not young women, said, well, gee, the University of Missouri is nice. You might like that. And the last second, I got in there. That's what I was doing there. Total accident.
I was listening to Garrison Keillor Saturday night on Very Home Companion. I don't know if you ever catch that show. It's on National Public Radio, and it's broadcast live every Saturday. Yeah, but I don't know if you ever heard my broadcast. Apparently you haven't, but I can dead roll the tape, and I take the material and I cut it. It's stringently edited, so it's not like a talk show.
I wanted to know how relaxed to be.
You'd be very relaxed, because I'm the guy who uses the razor blade to execute it the way I want. At any rate, I was listening to Garrison Keillor, if you ever heard that broadcast, and he has got a running gag in which he has purchased CBS, and he has moved it to Columbia, Missouri. He thought that would be a perfect location in two colleges. Stevens is there, isn't it?
Right.
Stevens College and the University of Missouri. And he was going to put all the CBS staff, the ones who are left, up in some prefab warehouse out on the edge of town someplace. Everybody lived there. They had cots and everything for everybody. So it was very funny. You ever listen to him?
No. I read a couple of very funny pieces of his. But there's no. I wrote this book called The Lonely Guy some time ago. And I thought it was over. But I'm still having lonely guy experiences. They never stop. For example, I was supposed to show up. I was supposed to get a job at the City College as a professor. And I needed to show some academic credentials. So I called the University of Missouri, wrote to them. They said, I'm sorry, we have no evidence that you've ever been here. I said, but sir, you know, I really, well, you know, from 1947, 1951, I was somewhere. I'm positive I was at the university. Sorry, absolutely. And there's still no evidence that I have. I began to doubt it. And finally, I found a crumpled up diploma and presented it to the dean. And he sort of took my word that I'd been there. Lonely guy experience.
Yes, it is a lonely guy experience. See, what you have to do is get yourself on the National Alumni Board of Directors. That means that, well, the University of Missouri, unless they're, if they're well-heeled, they'll fly you out there. If they're not, they will fly you to the nearest big city, or you fly to the nearest big city, and then they will pick you up in a station wagon or something. And if you're on the National Alumni Board of Directors, they give you a free place to stay, and they give you cocktail parties and dinners and lunches and a lot of boring speeches and receptions and things, too. And they believe that you actually went to college there that way.
Okay.
So, and besides, with your credentials as a writer, I mean, you'd be a natural for all the kids who are graduating in June send you resumes.
Doesn't mean a thing to them, evidently. You know, I'm big at Notre Dame, but my own school, you know, doesn't want to have anything to do with me.
Did you study?
Lonely guy.
You say you study journalism there.
Yeah, if you want to call, it was sort of something called agriculture. I think it was agricultural journalism. You know, it was all about, I had to memorize the names of turn of the century agricultural weeklies. And, I knew about silos and granges. And,
that's only for jobs in places like Des Moines and Lincoln, Nebraska, though.
It's not a classical education.
Well, the problem with journalism is that usually for a writer, it's a kiss of death. There are very few people who studied journalism and who became newspaper people or broadcasters who became writers.
I was talking to the publisher of the Detroit News. I said, where were you guys when I really needed you, when I couldn't get a job as a journalist? In other words, he said, well, how come you became a novelist and a serious type fellow? I said, well, because I couldn't get a newspaper job, which was true. I tried, and I just didn't look trustworthy. They never would give me, even at the University of Missouri, where you have that kind of semi-amateur newspaper with some wire coverage and the students go to, now I guess they call it intern. You know, I would get the weather and the drama criticism. But to actually cover something, there was something a little funny about me or fishy about me. I never got trusted with it. So I had to become a novelist, do the best I could.
Well, it's easier to make up stories anyway than to actually go out and cover it. And a lot more fun.
Which leads us.
Oh, we're going to get to Tokyo.
Talk about making up stuff, you know.
Oh, you're making up stuff. Well, a couple of newspaper people have recently made it as novelists. Not as funny as you are, but people like William McPherson, who wrote a very highly received first novel about 2 years ago called Testing the Current, and William Kennedy. He worked on newspapers in Albany and Puerto Rico and Miami. And he won the Pulitzer Prize this year.
Well, I may be going backwards, you know. In other words, maybe now it's time for me to get a newspaper job if I can.
Well, you better act now. You better act now while Rupert Murdoch still has the Post. He's selling it, you know, and nobody wants to buy it.
Well, you know, quite true. The way it worked is when I began to get a little attention as a novelist, I was finally able to get jobs as a journalist. I began to do a certain kind of journalism for, you know, different magazines.
I wouldn't trust you after reading Tokyo Woes. Why does it sound like I'm lisping when I say Tokyo Woes?
I don't know. The title came first, and Donald Fine, the publisher, said, Tokyo Woes, Tokyo, I keep hearing that in my sleep. Tokyo Woes, where's Tokyo Woes? You have to do Tokyo Woes. It was sort of like, a wild pun, and my family, I think my father was the pun guy.
But Donald Fine doesn't talk like that, Tokyo Woes, does he?
No. My father did puns, now that I think of it. And so it was a pun, but I wouldn't have used it just as a pun. It started to suit what I had in mind.
Well, let's go back a little ways. You got out of the University of Missouri in 1951. Is that correct? That's
what
you told me, just said. What happened to you after that? Here you were ironed with a sheepskin that you lost and found in a closet rolled up in a ball someplace many years later. But at that time, at least, you were youthful and ready to go and armed and somehow stuck in the Midwest, and you had to go someplace. So what happened to you?
Well, I turned up in the Air Force, working on an Air Force publication, taking pictures and doing some writing. I had an experience that kind of shook me up, so I didn't know how to deal with it, and I wrote a story about it and sent it to the New Yorker. And got one of those personal responses. They had a fellow who was assigned to what was unattractively called the slush pile, and fished it out and said, this looks interesting. What else do you have? Well, I didn't have anything else, so I quickly wrote something else, and then they published that, so that made me a published writer.
This was the New Yorker?
Yeah.
You know how many rejections they issue a year?
Well, back that time, it probably still is, but back that time, you were borne aloft on the shoulders of your fellow stickball players through the Bronx. That was big. That was really heady stuff. It was not followed quickly by another one.
That was a section that you wrote?
Yeah, it was a short story. And then the Air Force story I sold to another kind of scholarly review. And I was started in this highly unlikely career as a writer. Then I got a job at the magazine management company. I was the editor of Mail Magazine, Men, Man's World, and my favorite, which was called True Action, presumably.
Now, these are the magazines you don't pick up on Christopher Street.
The chic magazine of that group was True Magazine. Then came Argosy. And then there was a leap and a skip to our group. And even we weren't, the scrubby.
Macho magazines there, right?
Yeah, right.
How I pulled in a 500-pound trout in Lake Michigan.
Well, a lot of storming of beachheads. We finally ran out of beachheads and had to make some up. We ran out of wars. We had to make up a few battles. In fact, Mario Puzo worked on the magazines, and I would have him make up campaigns in World War II. Only quibbles you'd get is somebody would write a letter and say you had the wrong tank tread. I was in that battle. I stormed that beachhead. We'd do Anzio, and VJ Day and whatever, and we'd ran out, so he'd make some up, you know.
These magazines published in New York.
Yeah, it was a magazine management company, and at night I would commute back and pat the kids on the head, and then 10 o'clock at night I would start to write some books.
Long Island?
Yeah, in Glen Cove, and I'm not so sure it was the marriage flourished particularly as a result of it, but I got some books done.
And well, let's talk, before we go on, let's talk about that first book of yours. Tell me about that.
Well, the first published book.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
you had some false starts.
Yeah, I spent 3 years of my life, I was from age 26 to 29, writing, I seem to have to do one thing wrong to get it right, including getting married and to try one to get to a good one. It was that way. I had to write a book. It took 3 years, and I'm talking about it sort of teasingly now, but I don't remember any time in my life when I was more upset and frustrated, and when the gulf seemed so wide, something I kind of take for granted now, between being unpublished and age 30 looming up. And back then, for some reason, you know, the gods were Hemingway and Fitzgerald and Thomas Wolfe and age 30. 30 was a tough one. Somehow, if you don't step on the crack, you're going to get, you'll die tomorrow morning if you don't publish a novel. Somehow that, for a fellow who had no literary forebears or only 6 books in the house, all of a sudden that became important because I'd published some stories. Age 30 must publish a novel. Well, it didn't happen, and I guess I had a little bit of a quiet little breakdown over it. But I sneaked in under the wire by publishing 4 short stories in 1 weekend. And I was so thrilled, all to Playboy magazine, all of a certain different stripe, crazy stories. That kind of, I sneaked through, and before I knew it, I was past 30, and I was still alive, went to work, and in very short order, wrote a second book, and seemed to have learned from the quote bad one, how to write a decently structured book, and the rest fails to be history.
Tell me about book number 2, which became number 1 as a published novel.
I wrote. Been writing short stories all along. They came together as book number 2, a collection called Far From the City of Class.
Oh, this was a collection.
The second book, and then a third book was A Mother's Kisses, which kind of took off back then.
No, I'm a little lost now. We're talking about your first published book. That was a
collection. That was called Stern, the first published book, and that got some strong, I guess you call it strong literary attention, and sold kind of modestly, but it felt fine.
The same kind of humor that you have now polished and which you've made as your trademark?
Whatever that is, I think it was a darker book, a more uncomfortable book to write and possibly to read. Half the people who read it said they howled, and half said they were uncomfortable and cried, and a psychiatrist told me that his patients were bringing the book in and saying, here, this is how I feel, you know? So, always had a, I don't know if it's a problem, but I think there's a chance that I have, there's a professor at York College called up and says, do people know how to read you? Do you get taken wrong? Well, how can I answer that? In other words, he was going to go forth and explain to me in certain publications. I'd been doing that for Philip Roth. Well, I'm not sure I know how to read, or if I'm particularly getting, you know, you make of it what you will. I wrote that book as if I were being chased down the street, looking over my shoulder with police headlights on my neck, like a man on the run. And I think maybe that's, you know, in somebody said it had a kind of internal combustion. I don't know. I wasn't feeling so hot at that time, and I think the book was a way of expunging some of those feelings.
But the professor at your college, it's kind of interesting, having scholarly analyses of your work. If you're familiar with the poet Robert Lowell, he wrote about 12 books in his lifetime. They're all books of poetry, so they're very thin. They stretch, on my bookshelf, they stretch about that thick. I live in Manhattan, so we measure our collection by the foot. Because if we have too many feet, then somebody has to leave the apartment, or the books do. Anyway, the Lowell collection is about that big, and then books about Lowell stretch like that. So there's a, Robert, what has happened is a whole cottage industry has sprung up around Robert Lowell. People write their term papers and theses and things like that, and somehow they manage to get them published. And then there are biographies of Lowell. And for some reason, Lowell has become very popular. So I think that's something that you ought to shoot for. You tell the professor at your college that, yes, it's time to have some critiques of my work in printed form. And the more the better, because that way they'll even overshadow what you have written.
Well, size is kind of interesting. They used to have that phrase, the big one. Hemingway was, according to Lillian Ross, was padding across the river into the trees with, you know, just sort of padding it. He said, I've got the big one under my arm here. This is going to be the big one. And I remember I met James Jones, who I admired tremendously, and certainly that mountainous book that he wrote. And I was a little disappointed. He was leaving a saloon, and on the way out, he turned to me after an affectionate conversation that meant a lot to me. He said, "You haven't written the big one, Bruce." I don't know if I'd been fast enough, but in the best of all worlds, I would have said, "What about Pete Rose, Jim? You know, what about all those singles? Well, you know, singles hitter, Jim." But the big one, Voltaire's big ones, are moldering in the Louvre someplace. And his allegedly little one became his big one, Candide. It's all that we know about his work. Who else?
Literary history dictates what the big one is. I was reading something somewhere yesterday, and whoever was writing this article, a newspaper, Publishers Weekly, I don't know what, but said, "We're still waiting to get the big one from Norman Mailer." I mean, what do they want from the guy? He turns out something every year. What do they want from me?
I turned up at a little party at his house because I had greatly, I admired the executioner's song so much. And Kurt Vonnegut was there looking over at the executioner's song, which is about 900 pages. And he said, all my works could fit into that one work. And apparently it's not a big enough one for those people who want the big one.
The executioner's song is not typical Mailer, though. It's something different. But everybody said this Egyptian novel was supposed to be his big one, but then they didn't like it very much. And so they won another big one, but a bigger one.
Can't win that one.
No, so... don't worry about trying to write the big one. A lot of people, well, Paul Theroux says that he will probably never turn out a big one. He likes to write a book a year or turn out a book a year, and he thinks that he'll be judged on the basis of the body of his work and not for a single book. And Updike is like that, too. Updike comes out with a book. He just had a new book of poems, verse. And so he turns out something every year, and many of his books seem to be very, very thin.
Hey, what if he doesn't get judged at all? Did that ever occur to him?
That is really scary, not to be judged at all. You know how most writers don't get judged.
Yeah.
I talk to writers all the time, and publishers and editors, and they're buried by mounds of manuscript. And so all of these fledgling writers, many of these fledgling writers just don't, including myself, you know, they wind up writing for their drawer. And, you know, nobody reads it but them.
Well, it's a tough one to pull off, but I remember reading an interview recently with Robert Penn Warren in which he said when he'd reached what turns out to be my age, he was in Italy. And he said he began then to suddenly, maybe in the presence of the Italian ruins, to write for the thing itself. which he'd gotten away from, not for position or fame or whatever.
Now, when did he start to do this?
He claimed that he began to do this, I judge, to be in his early 50s. In other words, he
after All the King's Men.
Yeah.
Well, see, he can afford to do it after that.
Yeah. Well, right. I mean, maybe there's some rich heiress in the picture. I don't know. But I understood what he meant by that. It's a little bit what I was doing in this book vis-a-vis some of the other works I've done. Just trying to have some fun.
Well, I'm a little confused. There seems to be an overlapping area of creativity that you have here, because you have done a lot of material that has been made into motion pictures. Were you writing the film, the screenplays for these, like Splash? Splash, didn't you?
Yeah, that each one had a different history. Splash came to me as a two-line or two-word notion.
The mermaid.
Would you like to write a movie about a mermaid? One of your lonely guys, I'd just written The Lonely Guy, meeting or in falling in love with a mermaid. Well, I'd been interested in Legends of the Deep and Poseidon and felt like writing a love story. So I said, okay, let's go. That began in 1979 in that manner. The Lonely Guy is a book I wrote, or a collection of pieces that under that umbrella title that was acquired by the films. And I didn't participate in the screenplay.
I love that movie. I just happen to be a Steve Martin nut anyway.
I am too.
And I taped it, and I've seen that twice.
Oh, for goodness sakes.
I'm going to watch it a third time probably in August. I got to space these things out a little bit. But I thought that was a hilarious film.
I didn't work on the screenplay, and I loved the screenplay, and I felt quite a bit of it got lost. I didn't write it, but so I wasn't, evaluating my own work. I just loved the screenplay. Some of it slipped away, but people tell me they like to watch it on television. It may be that that's its natural environment. Other films, I had a film called The Heartbreak Kid that began as a short story that I published in Esquire.
Oh, that was terrific. That was the young couple who got married, wasn't it the young
couple? Fell to see someone on his honeymoon and realized...
Yeah, they went down to Miami, and she got very terribly... I didn't know you did that.
It was based on a story called Change of Plan that I wrote, published in Esquire, and it was acquired by the films. Neil Simon did the screenplay. Each one's been different. Stir Crazy, I wrote from the gun. It was called... As a matter of fact, we're going to be partners, because they picked up the television version for CBS, 8 o'clock at night, based on the same two characters. But that was written from the gun. Someone approached me and said, there's this phenomenon called the prison rodeo, and what do you think, and could we make some kind of story about that? And it began that way. So each situation's been different.
Steam Bath. Was that made as a... That was made as a play, though, not as a...
Yeah, first did that at the Truck and Warehouse Theater, starring and directed by Anthony Perkins, Hector Elizondo, in 1970. And then the PBS Hollywood Television Theater, KCET, did a filmed or taped version of it that really, got it around a lot, and that's the version people remember, if they remember it at all.
Well, they can remember it. It's on Showtime on a regular basis. Yeah. I get Showtime, and so I see it frequently.
I didn't participate in that, meaning
the Showtime version?
It says created by me. I haven't seen them. I guess I will one of these days.
They're pretty good. You must get residuals every time it's on. Or do you say, look, I created the idea and it's yours, and or there's a lump payment, or
get a royalty. No, back when I made the deal, nobody knew what cable was and et cetera, et cetera. So no sad stories, but it's kind of like a modest...
let's talk about Tokyo Woes. I feel like I'm lisping again. Tokyo Woes. I was baffled. Well, one, I had some comprehension of your humor, so I was prepared to chuckle my way through this, which I did. And it looks to me, I think you are putting on the Japanese to a degree, aren't you?
No. No, I'm not.
Well, now you talk about, there are all sorts of very, very funny things that kind of burlesque Japanese customs and traditions. For example, at the end there's the Harry Carey scene, and Mike walks up the steps and sees the head rolling down the steps, or I can't remember how it works exactly, but he sees
right.
There's the all of the in the Japanese elevator factory. They're making elevator cars, right? And here are all these very dedicated employees who stage a 15-minute strike, and here's the head of the company gets in there and fills in when somebody calls in sick or something like that. And now, are you telling me that you're not, in a way, kind of making fun of the Japanese?
Well, no more than I've ever... first of all, I never would set out to make fun of anything or anyone. It may just be a way of looking at the world. Detail by detail, the seppuku ritual is pretty well researched, so that everything has a seed of reality. The fella who's about to and really, if it's funny, it's the cross cultural confusion. Bill Atanabe asks his friend to give him a great honor. Will you be my kaishaku? I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right. In other words, chop my head off after I've used the short sword in my abdomen.
It's not too much to ask.
Well, it isn't in Japan. It would be a great honor, and it's essentially exactly what Mishima did. If forgive me, disemboweled himself and had his best friend, or his kaishaku, his first attendant admirer, gave him the great honor of actually cutting off his head.
Well, as you know, there's a laugh a minute in Tokyo Rose.
But as far as getting his loincloth cleaned, that would be accurate. So I said he'll if he can find a same-day dry cleaner, he'll be able to do the seppuku ritual that night. Well, okay. What I'm saying is that... It's pretty well researched, and then just taken 2 inches off the ground, slightly skewed. If that's putting on the Japanese, it's exactly what, you know, the way I work.
They deserve anybody who bombs Pearl Harbor deserves to. Well, is this going to be translated into Japanese?
I think it'd be fun. I don't know. My information is that the Japanese in Manhattan are buying the book. A bookseller I asked about said he wasn't sure about the Americans. The Japanese are just scooping them up. So there's an audience I never dreamed of. Lonely Japanese guys prowling the streets of Manhattan who can't get into cats.
Well, the Japanese are obviously lonely. They all stay in the same hotel. That's all they see is each other. Well, you know, you head to Tokyo after writing this book, you know, you got to be careful. There may be some zeros waiting for you. The kamikaze pilots is waiting to take off knowing that you're about to arrive.
I spoke to a group in Philadelphia, Pittsburgh. And it was in a book and author luncheon in a department store. The lights were so arranged that you really couldn't see the audience except for the front row. And in the front row, this is my first encounter with an actual Japanese person, was a sumo-type-looking fellow with his arms crossed, totally unsmiling, as we used to say, inscrutable. I began to falter a bit and defend the book and apologize for it. I never got my usual laugh lines. So I thought, well, maybe, what's he doing here? Did the embassy send him over? Why is he looking at me that way? Maybe he's just not a laugher. then the Baron Guy de Rothschild came on, who was not telling jokes, and the guy was cracked up, rolling on the floor. But everything Rothschild said. So that was uncomfortable. I myself would like to read, if there was such a thing as an equivalent of me in Japan, a fellow who wrote whatever kinds of books I do and whatever kind of writing I do, I'd be curious to read the work of someone like that who'd never been to this country and was forming his impressions from reading Jack London or Norman Mailer and seeing Dynasty and seeing American movies and just the general cultural stuff that would come his way. It'd be sort of fun.
It would be fun. I have a feeling, however, that Japanese people are really only humorous by default. Have you ever seen... Is there such a thing as Japanese humor? I mean, it's very hard to imagine. The Japanese seem to be such a sober, serious people.
I think it may be by accident, but I remember my early books seem to have performed well in Japan, and I corresponded with the Japanese translators. That wasn't being funny, but somebody would say the questions were, who is Xavier Cugat? Is he the well-known Latin American revolutionary as we suspect, et cetera, et cetera? But I began to wonder why this interest. I was also interested in the technology first. I was living alone. My only friends were little TV sets and little pieces of equipment that I was getting that were so exquisitely made. Then I looked into the literature, and there's a writer named Tanizaki, for example. Appealed. Instantly, I felt a kind of affinity. One story in particular about a fellow who lives in a chair in a hotel, a huge baronial chair in Tokyo, and he lives in it. He goes into it in the wee hours and spends all day in that chair. Well, back in that time, it's a kind of story I might have written. You know, still may.
A lonely guy like yourself, you certainly have picked a lonely occupation for yourself, haven't you?
Well, I'm not. What happened after the lonely guy? When I finished the last words of the lonely guy, I met a woman who became my girlfriend and who's now my wife, thereby invalidating everything I said in the book.
Well, I really enjoyed reading Tokyo Woes. What is it? I always feel like I'm lisping when I say that. But it was really a funny book, and I enjoy your work, and I'm delighted that you came in. We talked more than I expected. I hope to have you back, and we'll talk some more, and
that'll be a treat.
I'd like to follow your career as it as you work toward the big one as the big one comes up. You go to Elaine's quite a bit, don't you? You hang out at Elaine's.
I haven't been there. There may be a cardboard effigy of me there because I pop in more and more infrequently. I've been living in the country, and I did have a rush when I first began to live out there year-round. And at midnight, I rented a limousine. I was embarrassed about that, but it was that important. And they said it'll take an hour for the fellow to get his uniform. I said, forget that. Just get him over here immediately. I needed a fix, so to speak. And he drove me to Elaine's. And I got there at 2 in the morning and saw the same people kind of at that particular hour slumped over tables, and I got back in the car and said, take me back, and I've never gotten that urge since.
I used to live across the street from Elaine's in one of the great big modern building called the Yorkshire Towers, and I have never, even though Elaine's was only, that was at 86th Street, and Elaine's is 88th, and I've never been to Elaine's, even though I live practically across the street, and I swore a long time ago that, one, I didn't want Elaine to insult me. And so I swore the only time I would ever go into Elaine's is when I go in with Woody Allen. Now, I don't know Woody Allen, and he's never offered to take me to Elaine's, but I'm holding out, so I will go to Elaine's first time Woody Allen invites me.
I've never seen anybody treated rudely. In my observation, what would happen is, the scenario, I think, at the height of its popularity, maybe it's still at the height of its popularity, is a woman would say to her husband, let's go up to Elaine's, you know, see what it's all about. And he'd say, Archie, what do you want to do that for? You know, we did well, we go to that place? And she said, oh, I'm curious. I just like to go. So he'd, it was like the wrench story. He'd start getting dressed and anticipating what was going to happen and sweep in there, and the place would be authentically crowded. I mean, you know, other restaurants get crowded, including, you know, her place then and now. So he'd come in and say, I'd like a table for two, and they'd say, you know, legitimately, it'd be a 40-minute wait or something like that. He'd pound the fist on the bar and say, I told you that. You know, I told you this would happen, and sweep out with his wife, you know, and I've seen that kind of thing.
There's a wonderful scene, if you read or saw the movie Diary of a Mad Housewife, Richard Benjamin and Kerry Snodgrass.
I did see it. Yeah.
And there's this wonderful scene where Richard Benjamin, of course, is a social climber. They live on Central Park West. They want to go to Elaine's. They're not getting along very well anyway. And they go to Elaine's and they sit there and very stiffly by themselves eating their pasta. Remember that scene? And they're very uncomfortable with each other, very uncomfortable in Elaine's because people seem to know each other. The bar is crowded and the waiters are very formal. Yeah. And it didn't seem to be any reason for their being there. I mean, they didn't. Elaine's has this reputation of being kind of like a club, anyway.
It is a bit, and it's all it ever meant to me is that at a kind of uncomfortable period in my life, as if writers ever have a comfortable period, you know, the marriage was breaking up. It sounds like an ice floe or something was breaking up. Marriage was breaking up. Anyway, I really didn't, didn't know what to do with myself. And a friend of mine named Jack Richardson took me up. They said it looked warm and cozy, and there'd be some writers around. Elaine was sort of a pal. And it never stopped being. That was, you know, before, the Jacqueline Onassis's came in. And,
what did she write?
And she
wrote a coloring book with her sister.
She's an editor. She's literary.
Do you, you mentioned that you... friends with James Jones, you mentioned Kurt Vonnegut. Do you associate with writers a great deal?
Not really. Most of my friends in the Hamptons, there are writers out there. Most of my pals are bartenders. It's a fact. I mean, it's how we shun each other. But
this past summer, I went to Bobby Vann's for the first time because I wanted to pay my respects to James Jones. And Truman Capote had just died, too, at that time. And, of course, I do that famous photograph over the bar was there.
That's a wonderful picture, seems to me.
It's John Knowles,
Willie Morris, James Jones, and Truman Capote. It happens to be a wonderful picture.
Yeah. I knew James Jones slightly. I thought he was a wonderful guy, and he was such a nice guy to me. And I have all of his books, and I admired him a lot. He could have benefited from some stringent editing. It seemed to me that somehow, maybe, I don't know if he fought with his editors, or I don't know, but his writing seemed to go out of control a little bit, with great amounts of repetition and redundancy.
A classic case of having to live up to that first book. You'd think it'd be enough to write one wonderful book. But it's not in this country.
Can't live on it.
Well, he almost could have, but I mean, it's not. I mean, the pressures that Mr. Voltaire, you've done Candide, but what have you done lately? I think it was one of those cases that happened. O'Hara never stopped hearing about appointment in Samara. Hemingway, I'm sure, was dogged by The Sun Also Rises, and the case and Philip Roth. Goodbye, Columbus. Maybe Saul Bellows had another kind of career, but those—I mean, in my view, those early books were the rich ones.
O'Hara is a writer whose work has just been eclipsed, and he's not a red writer these days. I don't know if his material is dated, or if he just wasn't that good. I just don't know. But during his lifetime. I mean, he was being mentioned as a Nobel Prize winner and all of that, and something happened to him.
I don't know if you call it a revival, but there was, about a month ago, his publisher put out a book called The Best of, 50 Short Stories, The Best of O'Hara, and was reviewed Well, and I don't know whether that will trigger anything. I don't know. I sure did like to read him, though.
Who do you like to read today?
There's a writer.
Do you like comedic writers or series writers?
Not especially. There's a writer. I've had a long an appointment with a writer named Anthony Pohl. I'm pronouncing it that way only because he himself said it rhymes with Lowell, P-O-W-E-L-L. He has a 12-volume work called A Dance to the Music of Time, which is one of the most remarkable works I've ever read.
I'm familiar with him.
He was a kind of his writing career ran parallel to that of Evelyn Waugh. And Evelyn Waugh,
is he an American writer?
No, an English writer who lives among us. I mean, who exists today. And it's a 12-volume work. My wife ferreted out 4 volumes. There are 3 books to a volume. And the dance to the music of time, essentially it means the characters, the same characters keeps showing up over a period of 40 or 50 years. It's written in the first person. It starts following a group at Oxford in the post-World War I period and comes up almost to the present. It's almost like it's as if Dickens were alive and among us and commenting on screenplay writing. Odd types of considerations come up. No hesitation in calling him the most gifted living writer that I know of. Waugh, who again wasn't liberal in his praise, acknowledged in his view that he shared this feeling of mine. Amazing that he's alive, and that I've gotten to read him. I've read. I'm now on the. I think I've read 11 of the 12, and starting to get sad about it. It coming to an end. Beyond that, for the most part, I read history.
Any particular period?
Well, it's a matter of making up for that that University of Missouri agricultural journalism degree, and it's a kind of filling in the holes process. In my case, they're mostly holes, so I kind of leap around.
You know, there's an apocryphal story about Marilyn Monroe. After she married Arthur Miller, she was going to get culture and read the great books, so she started with the alphabet, starting with all the books with the letter A, all the authors with the letter A. I think she got up to C. That's really tough, I'm going to read the great books starting A to Z.
I wasn't thinking so much of the great books filling in periods of history.
What's interesting about history is that sometimes history is translated very well into novels. I know it's a popular approach, but John Toland, for example, has written a number of histories of World War II. He has a novel out, which is a history of World War II. He's consolidated almost everything he has learned as a historian and has created a cast of characters. It's going to be a trilogy. It's going to be that thick.
Wow.
So, it's actually done extremely well. Listen, I know that you probably have another appointment, and I've kept you longer. I usually limit these conversations to 30 minutes, and one of the tapes has already run out.
This is your big one.
This is the big one. But I'm sure we could go on talking forever.
Yeah,
but
it's been a treat for me. Yeah.
So I really appreciate you coming in, and I'd look forward to talking to you, and I'm glad that has been realized. And we'll do it again, I hope.
I sure did enjoy it.
Oh, good.